Welcome to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with us today we have a repeat guest, one of my favorite poets, a local Fairfield poet, Lawrence Iyer. Now, Lawrence was born in Iowa along the Mississippi River, holds a BA from Yale in American Studies, and has taught history and coached tennis for 40 years at Maharishi School in Fairfield, Iowa. He's the author of Heartland Haiku in 2019 and Haiku Country 2020. And his new book is Haiku Americana, just recently published in 2025. Welcome back to Writers' Voices, Lawrence.
Thank you, Monica. 5 years ago was the last time, so I'm delighted to be back.
And I'm still here. And we're both still here.
We both are.
Yes.
And so is Haiku.
Now, most of us remember from our elementary school days that Haiku was a Japanese poetry form. Do you know when it originated?
Actually, I don't. I have to admit, except for my third grade introduction in Moline, Illinois, which is across the river from Davenport, where I was born, except for that, I had no acquaintance with haiku. And truthfully, after that fun first year of writing 5-7-5 3-line verses, which I enjoyed a lot, I never wrote another one for over 60 years. It's a confession. This is a confession. I guess I'm making up for lost time, because since 2017, it's now beyond the hundreds level of haiku. It's in the over 1,000 to 2,000. I can't seem to stop.
Wow.
It is true. It's Japanese in origin. And I was starting to feel a little bit, like I was not doing justice to the form by having topics that I was told after the fact, well, that really isn't Japanese haiku style. All I followed deliberately was 5-7-5. In fact, as the author's note in this book says, I kind of arrived at a place where I realized this is all I have as a rule, one rule. I follow the code 5-7-5 all day long, but the rest is free. So realizing that finally and deciding that was okay, and that would probably qualify as its own style, that Haiku Americana finally felt legit.
so that's what was it that made your haiku not fit the traditional Japanese form?
Thank you. It's the topics. I'm told, you know, customarily it's almost exclusively nature. And in season, and there are certain conventions involving twists at the end, which I certainly enjoy, especially in the joke haiku. But it was really the seasonal nature settings that were kind of engraved in people's expectations as far as what haiku is. I was told by a professor, a friendly but somewhat snooty professor, that I was really writing was senryu, and that allows, you know, daily human life commentary, proverbs in a way. It involves, you know, postage stamp portraits, I would call it, where you can give a picture of a person or a place in those 3 lines. So I stuck with that, and at first felt a little bit guilty about it, as I said, but I never really intended to write in the manner that the royal, you could say, tradition of haiku was created. So I just started writing 3-line verses with the 5-7-5 meter and called it haiku because it's close enough. And I've really enjoyed it ever since.
What got you started doing it?
In 2017, I've looked back at how it all might have begun. Two things happened in 2017. I finished my career as a college tennis coach at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, and moved back here to Fairfield to a beautiful cottage setting about 8 or 9 miles north and west of Fairfield, Iowa. So in Jefferson County, population of the county less than 20,000, nearest town Fairfield, where we are now, about 10,000, actually slightly less. A lot of space, a lot to see. And I remember one of the first times I thought to write, I looked at the sky, and I was born in Iowa, as you know, as you said. And the sky is such a prominent feature here because there's so much of it. There's nothing in the way as far as seeing it, no mountains. And I wrote one of the very, very first haiku was about the sky as the ocean, the oceanic sky. It was, our hearts sail on sky. Iowa's bright blue ocean calls us home to you. I still remember it. And that was one of the inspirations, was just to be out in the countryside and taking a look, a closer look for a change, at nature that I'd just kind of ridden through on my bike or driven through in cars for so many decades. The second feature, I think, was one of my best friends from Yale, who had been a sculptor, a stone sculptor, terrific athlete, died quickly of Lou Gehrig's disease in 2017. And I think coming to terms with one, not only my own and my friend's mortality, but just with the changes in life that can happen so quickly, made me a little bit more mindful of life.
More and introspective.
Yes, I think I would say that, and try to come to terms with all the features of life, and enjoying the challenge of trying to express what it all seemed to mean day to day, in such a compressed form. It is easy to write a haiku in one sense, and also incredibly hard because it's unforgiving. There are only three lines, and it's 5, 7, 5, and it ain't haiku if it isn't that.
You know, you talk about the sky as sort of being one of the things that motivated you or inspired you to begin with. And I've had a conversation recently. I was in Europe and was in Italy, Lake Como, overlooking Como. You know, I was up on the hillside overlooking Como, and there was a beautiful sunset. And I have been to a lot of places around the world where people go because of the beautiful sunsets. And they are gorgeous. Another one is like I went to Santorini one time, and there's a point at the very north. It's an island, a Greek island, and there's a point at the north. I think it's called Ia, OIAs or something like that. And people come from all around the world to see the sunset. And it is amazing because it sets into the ocean. But we have just as beautiful sunsets here in Iowa, just as beautiful.
Absolutely, an unobstructed view. also, our sun rises. I delight in being out there when the sun rises in Iowa. That certain cheerfulness for the whole day comes from being there, being present at that moment. So we'll take it. Both ends of the day are a delight here. Yeah. And in a more quieter way, inspiring.
Absolutely. So, you know, you started writing this poetry. What motivated you to start publishing?
I didn't have it in mind to publish it at all. I guess I wrote them for 2 years before I did publish one. Some people, I would post them on, you know, Facebook or Instagram, and sometimes on what was called Twitter then, X, and get encouragement from people, hey, you should put these together and, you know, make a collection. And I thought, well, why not? Mm-hmm. And it was really, why not? I realize now this is the third time I've done the why not. And this time around with Haiku Americana, I had 5 years worth of haiku to sort through truthfully and decide what should go in or what could go in. And it became a larger task, a very happy challenge to sort out what I wanted in this book and what maybe would go in another one.
Lawrence, do you write your poems manually or on computer?
I use a pen and pencil.
And then at some point you type them in?
Yes.
Do you wait until you have a whole bunch of them and then type them all up? Or
No, that's a great, great question. I tend to write them on post-it notes. God bless the people who invented post-it notes. You can fit a whole haiku on there pretty handily. If I post it at all on one of the social media, it goes up pretty soon after that. Sometimes they'll incubate for, you know, a day or two. Other times they'll be around and I find these scraps. Oh yeah, 6 months ago I was going to work this one all the way to a conclusion I liked. So I do have a pretty big pile of post-it notes that I'm constantly going through, and I do type them in as they reach kind of either the posting stage on the social media, or I realize, hey, I better gather these together before they blow away in the wind. I did lose some one time in the wind.
Oh, and
it was a crestfallen day. I realized, well, they'll either come back because they're worth coming back, or they won't. And some of them came back in memory, but others are gone with the wind.
So, well, you know the story of Hemingway having lost all of his writing on a train. His wife was going to surprise him by bringing it to him when he was off on an assignment, and she went out to get a sandwich and came back, and everything was gone. But there are people who, well, there's a couple things. One, that may have been the beginning of the end of that marriage, but the other thing was that it may have been what made him so good, because he instead of reworking these things that he had done in the past, he had to start over.
Yes.
But he was starting over from a much further advanced skill level.
Yes.
And,
No, it's certainly true. I remember shuddering when I read that long ago. And I'm not surprised. I didn't know the backstory on their marriage, but I'm not surprised it affected things.
Yeah.
It's definitely true that coming back to it later often reworks even a three-liner or a six-liner. In this book, for the first time, I've allowed myself to do what many songwriters do. On some of these, you know, could end up being at least the choruses of songs, which is to stack haiku, as they call it. They'll put three lines, you know, 5-7-5 on top of each other. This is actually the Beatles did that a lot, surprisingly. She came in through the bathroom window, protected by a silver spoon. That's a haiku. And now she sucks her beer by the banks of her own lagoon. That's another haiku. They just stacked them. And so it shows up in songwriting a lot, particularly in country songwriting. And gives a little more latitude to express a postage stamp portrait. You know, you can say a few more things or get a little bit more of a story told in six lines or nine. And to my surprise, in this third book, I've done a lot more of that. You know, kind of, if you want to say, the bread and butter of what I do remains the three lines that'll fit on a post-it note. But it's also true, I've got some other notepads that I write. I put more lines on because there's a little bit more to say every once in a while.
Well, as I was reading Haiku Americana, I was thinking, you know, it'd be interesting to try and write a novel in haiku or a short story, you know.
Yes. I've heard it's been done and people have done it, and bless them. I think it, you know, I really, my hat is off to anyone able to do that. It would be fun to have a set of characters and follow them through in an airtight book in that way, following the verse. Well, at this stage, at least I'm starting to expand.
I've had some guests who wrote in verse, you know, wrote novels or stories in verse. I think Jacqueline Woodson. They often are geared towards young adults, or but I mean, didn't Homer write in verse?
Yes. I realize how great, you know, the greats were and have been, and certainly Shakespeare wrote in verse.
Mm-hmm,
incredible what people have been able to do within the constraints of a rhythmic, you know, really format that is unyielding. My hat is off to them. If I'm able to progress beyond having the hooks, so to speak, or the choruses for songs, into something a little longer, I'll feel that's at having started at age 70 would be a victory of sorts.
Lawrence, have you ever experimented with other forms of poetry, other meters?
I confess, only as an academic requirement in college. We had it in my first year in 1966 and 67, we had an English poets course. And one of our assignments, at least in our section of it, was to write in the manner of Milton, in the manner of, you know, other great poets in the English tradition. It was a very useful exercise, even if it was infuriating. You know, one, we saw great respect for the way Pope put his couplets together, or the way Milton had written in Paradise Lost. But on the second side of it, it was not just infuriating and intimidating. We got to walk in their shoes and feel what it was like. But truthfully, that's the only other time. And that was, you know, long, long ago, almost 60 years ago now. So I think I have, again, the simplest form to come back to for me. And I still don't know why I chose it or why it chose me, which is the haiku.
Well, haiku is one of the most accessible forms for people.
Yes. I do. It's fun because people start, you know, well, they'll send me a note or email, or they'll call me, or I'll see them on the town square, and they'll say, "You got me counting syllables. What are you doing?" You know, and it's, so I'm not trying to, but it's true that I count syllables all the time. And it's a habit. And people feel like, hey, I can reply in haiku. And I take delight in that on the social media when people write back using the 575. And it really is a lot of fun. It's also, you know, if you try to say something worthwhile, is a challenge, because it is, it's so severe. There's just not much room. Every wasted syllable you pay for later.
I wonder, has anyone ever had a haiku battle, like on stage?
Yeah.
Where,
like,
you're giving a topic and you have to come up with haiku.
Battle.
Yeah.
I've seen it happening, and I'm sure there are some people who would delight in that. I personally, you know, the tricks of meter and rhyme and of kind of the sound flow that can be created and remembered are part of writing haiku. But for me, I admit to less attraction for that. There are people who've kind of challenged me. There was a video series called Epic Rap Battles of History. And they would have, you know, Joan of Arc, you know, versus, and they had these way back, about 20 years ago, actually. And they had their own charm, but they quickly devolved into kind of dissing matches, you know, putting words back into historical characters' mouths and making it kind of put downs. And so it could get dry pretty fast. But the idea of being able to come up instantaneously, that does happen sometimes. It really does. You know, there's a 45-second haiku sometimes. Other times there's a 45-minute haiku. And other times there's a 45 days of, I never did get this right. Sometimes I have to admit, I've had experiences that I've tried to remember. You know, something happened 35 years ago, something happened in childhood, finding a way to say it many, many years later, you know, the emotion of the moment that recollected in tranquility, I remember was a phrase that Wordsworth used, that was for him poetry. So a very an exciting prospect in a way, because it means I can retrieve childhood experiences or long ago experiences and enjoy that if I can find a way to say it.
Oh.
My mother just turned 98 years old last week, And things that she has talked about as a child, she, you know, when the year she was born, Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic to Paris. Well, and here she is, you know, people have flown in outer space. It extraordinary changes in the world, and she's been around the whole time. She used to take a ferry boat across from Rock Island, Illinois, to Davenport for a nickel. And the bridge, there was no car access to bridges at that point. So it is being able then to kind of draw upon memory, whether a collective memory or just personal memory, is, I think, a feature that's attractive with the short format of haiku.
Wow. When I was asking about like a haiku challenge or contest, yeah. I saw a pun contest down in Austin a few years ago. They have they have something there for O. Henry. It's some like kind of maybe it was his house or something. And every year they would have this punning contest. And two people get up and they'd be given a topic and they'd trade puns until somebody couldn't think of a new one.
Until everyone goes, no. Yes. It would be a lot of fun. I do think that the format begins to take over after a certain point in the contest. But I'm sure somewhere there's a high likelihood of having haiku contest.
Yes. So in Haiku Americana, how did you decide what went in this book? And is there any kind of overall theme or structure?
Well, it's a great question. It was one I was thinking about last night because I realized, while it's not true that there's no rhyme or reason to what made it into the book, the rhyme or reason may not be always evident. I thought the name of your show, you know, if I moved the apostrophe back to the left, that the writer's voices and one writer's voices, I've adopted multiple voices in this book to try to give expression to differing points of view about time itself, or about history, or about now, but from several points, several angles that may in fact not blend with each other so well. There's one point there, I think you saw the one where I wrote about the angel of death drove down to Georgia and tore those guidestones to the ground. Hell yeah, his Mustang loosed the lightning that showed God's taking down the clowns. Words all over town. There's whirlwind and thorn trees when the man comes around. Well, the last two lines are Johnny Cash, and that's as angry a song and foreboding a song and warring voice as I've ever tried to express. It's not really my personal style of things at all. And yet, I thought it gave honest voice to the expression of a lot of experience at this time in history.
Yes, for sure. There was another one that was, you know, wouldn't be exactly what I'd say was your voice, but I loved it. I don't... Better not blame God for the road we're riding on.
It's your own. It's our own asphalt, and you can spell it two ways: ASPHALT, and then the other way that we just heard. Yeah. So I'm glad you caught it. I'm taking chances in a way with. Yeah, I want to stretch my own voices into multiples instead of only one.
So the one right above that is one that you stretched into six, and I wasn't quite sure what you were saying in that one. Do you want to?
Okay.
Because I don't know what the Winnemucca Blues is.
Okay, so that's an actual personal experience with my college roommate. Driving in Nevada, Winnemucca, Nevada was the nearest town. It was about 100-degree day. And it had been 100 degrees, you know, for days on end, according to reports. And within about a 15-mile stretch, we blew three tires on his GTO. Goodness. And so I decided that was the blues. That way, for us, that moment was the blues without any question. And so I decided, all right, I can make that blues song. A memory of that is a blues song. So It's 110. GTO has got 3 bone tires, and God is laughing. And so, yeah, it was fun to write that in a voice that really isn't one of my own custom.
I was going to go through a little bit of the, just pick out a few poems and ask you about them, where they came from, what they meant. And I wondered, one was right near the beginning, and I don't know if you do this elsewhere in the book, but you actually give a nod to maybe what inspired this, which was True Detective season 1, episode 8.
Yes.
So why don't you read that poem and then tell us the story behind it?
Well, the story in True Detective, one of the characters is really wanting to break free from being forced to be in a hospital after being injured. I don't know the full context. I've just seen on YouTube this exchange between the two characters, where one wants to be sprung from the hospital, wants to walk away from it. The other, being aware of how frail the man's health is, how fragile the situation is, doesn't want him to go, but realizes rather quickly that he's going to go no matter what. And the one who is trying to break free from confinement in the hospital actually is usually the cynic. He's usually the one that has virtually nothing to say that is upbeat about the state of things. And so for him in this moment of vulnerability to say, there's just one story, the oldest, light versus dark. Used to be all dark. Now look at the sky. Dark's got more space, but ask me, I'd say light's winning. And so it's an amazing turnabout for him in his heart, and he gives voice to it. And I turned it into that stacked haiku.
Now, did you have to change the words he was saying somewhat, or is this a direct quote?
A little bit. I had to tailor it so the syllables would fit, but the message and the sequence of the lines is almost exact. So it was quite striking, especially given the background of the character being the jaded.
Now, was that the Matthew McConaughey character?
Well, I don't know the names of these actors. People say, hey, and my wife knows all of them. And I don't know who's who. I apologize. I just saw that exchange, and I knew the background enough that one. And if that Matthew is, he had the darker hair. Oh, there's Woody Harrelson.
Was Woody Harrelson was the other one. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Woody was more light. Yeah. Matthew McConaughey would have been the darker, the more cynical.
Yep. Well, that makes sense to me. Yeah. He's the one guy I recognize. Oh yeah. That's Woody Harrelson.
Yeah. And he's very, that was a very well acted drama.
And everyone who's ever seen the entire drama, has said exactly that.
Yeah.
That this was really a crucial point within the entire series.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Lawrence Iyer, author of Haiku Americana. And we're just dissecting a few of the poems in this book. So the next one I wanted to ask you about is on page 8. And I think maybe there's two of them that are, even though they aren't stacked, they might be related.
Beans, yes, all three.
For Elm Grove. Oh, all three of them. Okay. So tell us a little bit. Go ahead and read those and then tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. It is true that sometimes they'll take a one whole page. You notice that maybe there's no particular noticing, but in this book, I put three haiku per page quite often if they were three liners. And in that situation, I'm trying to show that while they're not stacked right on top of each other, they do have some relationship. And so this one is about in Jefferson County, Iowa, at the county fairgrounds, there's an entire one-room schoolhouse that was brought over from a point out in the county as an attempt to preserve it. And it had to pass muster with the engineers. Can it make a 2-mile trip through the gravel roads and over to the county fairgrounds? And the answer, to the astonishment of many, because this was from the 1860s, you know, is that this school is structurally sound. And so we're going to, and it's over there now. So anytime if you go to the county fairgrounds, you can see. So here's the three poems. When stars line upright, we get to hear the stories only trees can tell. Beams for Elm Grove School No. 4 came straight from a hollow down the hill. Fell the year after Lee surrendered to Grant, they're sturdy to this day. And that's God's truth. You can walk in it. We had, when I worked for Carnegie Museum here in town, one summer of 2023, we had a reunion for anyone who'd gone to one of the 99 schools, one-room schools in Iowa, in this county alone.
There were 99?
Yes, there were. If you look at the maps from the 1870s, you'll see that there was a place carved out in the acreage in every single one of the townships. So that no child, it was actually a law passed by the Iowa legislature, that no child would ever have to walk more than 2 miles to school. And so they had them across the state that way, thousands, actually. That there were more one-room schools in the state of Iowa than any other school, any other state having schools that were in the rural areas. So it was a provision for education that Iowa is justly famous for.
Yes.
And when we had a reunion, we had a full house. It's on YouTube, and Carnegie Museum has it. It was fun to hear. There were even some teachers in their 90s who were present for this, and students who are well up in years who had all gone to one-room schools in Jefferson County, and including at least one who had gone to this very school, Elm Grove School No. 4, and had it in her heart to make sure it was well-kept. And she was there helping with the transfer, which happened in the late 1960s. So it's quite remarkable. And that's why I wanted to put us in a series of three short haiku, that it really did happen. And it's probably many more like it. And the memories live on, and the trees are the ones who contain that memory.
So when did these schools cease functioning?
1959, at least, was pretty much the watershed moment. Here in this county, in fact, that was the year the rural schools had to begin busing kids into the town school.
Wow. That's like in my lifetime.
Sure. Yeah, it was amazing. It was, you know, just after, two or three years after, I had learned how to ride haiku in Moline, Illinois. So I guess it all worked together at some point.
But you never went to a one-room school.
No, ma'am. I was a town kid with country roots, I guess you'd say, farm roots, but a town kid.
Yeah, there were a lot of those in Iowa.
That's true. Yeah, great-grandpa. Yeah. And grandpa worked for John Deere, and so did my dad. And I went to John Deere Junior High in town. So it was a company town in Moline. It's the world headquarters of John Deere.
So no Yale's surprise. A long ways from Moline, Illinois.
That's true.
How did that happen?
I'm delighted not to know. No, I'm grateful that Yale actually began in the mid-60s to sense that it was becoming really provincial, having primarily too much of their student body be based on prep schools from the East or from a few select suburban areas around the country, and beginning to feel that they'd be losing out on the richness of student experience everywhere. And in training what that at the time they hoped would be potential leaders for the next generation. That was their viewpoint stated. And so they deliberately fanned out to the hinterlands and came to Moline High School. I didn't know it was in New Haven, Connecticut. You know, I'm grateful that they sought us out. And I quickly learned as much as I could about Yale. But grateful that they had that change of philosophy, really, in their admissions policy. It was still an all-guy school. I was in the last all-male class in 1970. Wow. Our senior year, there was coeducation, but no, you know, why admit women for 1 year of school and then graduate. So we were the last all guys class. So a hinge point in a way in the institutional history. And again, I'm grateful and still mystified, you know, that it worked out the way it did.
Now, was your family supportive of you going so far away to college?
I think they were astonished. Not that I hadn't been a good student, I had, and you know, other things in high school, but it was far. It was definitely a reach. But they view it as an adventure, as I did, and they encouraged me to go for it. And it's been rewarded so many times over, both during the experience and in the 55 years ago now when graduation was, with lifelong friendships from people from all around the country. And I tried in this haiku book to have some of the memories of those people show up. I wrote one of the poems. It's about a rocking chair, that an old rocking chair moves to all the memories stirring upon it. And many of those memories were of my classmates and friends from college, some of whom have passed on. And I wanted to, you know, give them honor in a way that a short verse possibly, you know, could give me a chance to do. I wrote one about a man who became the dean of a prestigious divinity school, national class divinity school, with multiple degrees to his name. And deep down, though, he was still a kid from Oklahoma who played guitar and had grown up on country. And so I wrote, deep down, he's still an Oklahoma boy who loves three chords and the truth.
Oh.
And that was a way to honor him. He just passed on this year.
Wow. There was, I can't find it now, but there was one I was going to ask you about that I thought had some roots in Yale because it referred to the Whiffle Puffs.
Oh, the Whiffen Poofs. Yeah, thank you.
The Whiffen Poofs.
Yeah, the very first, the oldest collegiate singing group in the United States, 1909, was the Whiffen Poofs. Cole Porter himself was a Whiffen Poof. I got to sing in the Whiffen Poofs. It's only seniors. In fact, that man who I've just spoken about, we sang together in the Whiffen Poofs.
And, do you want to share that poem with us?
Sure. This is another of our the guys in the group. There are 14 voices, and we certainly had spread out to the whole world rather quickly after graduation. One moved right after graduation to Israel and married a beautiful, wonderful to this day, Israeli woman. We sang together in your kitchen at Christmas in Jerusalem. Two Whiffen Poofs and a beautiful angel joined in song forever. So that's for my friend. We sang standing in a horseshoe. It was all a cappella, you know, and we had to key our singing according to the voices to our left and right, as well as the overall sound of the group. And my friend and I, who's in this poem, stood next to each other the entire year, and at every reunion since, where we've ever been able to get together and sing. And when we went to his kitchen in Jerusalem, in this very small apartment just after graduation from college, I made sure that I was stationed right using the same ear to hear him. We realized, yeah, this is the proper formation. It was really a poignant moment for all of us and for his wife too, who's there. She's a beautiful angel.
There's another one pretty early in the book that I think is an Iowa story, perhaps.
Okay.
Over two pages about old Mr. Davis.
Yes, it's certainly true. When Chief Blackhawk had to be displaced from his homelands, at the Quad Cities, where the Rock River flows into the Mississippi, was really the headquarters of the Sauk tribe that he was, you know, he was the chief of Iowa land, really was part of that kingdom, you might say, and he had to give up lots of territory and make it available by treaty. He lived in Iowaville, actually, the last few down close to Ottumwa, but on the Des Moines River. And it's true that the marker that surveyors made from Scott County, where Davenport is, all the way south and west, as a condition of that Black Hawk Treaty in 1832, passed through Fairfield. It actually, there, and this is the story, and I'll tell you the story because we cannot find, and no one in the street department, it's no one says, but everybody knows that there are chunks of this time, this marker of the Black Hawk Treaty that were around in Fairfield. Old Mr. Davis broke his mower on a stone marker in his yard, took hammer to it, tossed all the pieces in a box in his garage. Assembled fragments spell the tale. Black Hawk Purchase, 1832. Truth. It's the truth. It happened. And there are chunks of it somewhere in Jefferson County.
and then it goes on from there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is true, too, that there was a man who was very, you know, there are very few roads in the early years of the 1830s that go east or west and away from the Mississippi River toward, you know, where we are. And one man in what was called Parsonsville, no relation to the college, just up and decided to take all his oxen and, you know, lash them together and just plow away to this little town of Fairfield. Fairfield was a land office town. So 8 head of oxen pulled a sodbuster plow through tall prairie grass straight west toward Fairfield. Today, we drive that line as Highway 34, and it's darn close to the path that he carved with those oxen.
Wow.
So, and then because we're in a town where we hear the whistles of the train, we hear the roar of the train every night, even though in town itself, they're not allowed to blow the horns. I wrote one at the end of this. Yearning hearts ride the roar of distant trains across the darkened prairie. And I thought that matched.
That reminds me of that song, something about when you hear the whistle blow, then you'll know that I have gone.
Yes.
500 miles, I think. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I had thought that
song.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. I part of a song. I hadn't thought of that song at the time, but that's the same flavor. Right?
Yeah.
Rural life has its own, one, charm, certainly. But two, there are certain things we hear more when there's fewer sounds to choose amongst. We hear more in nature sounds and then more in the man-made sounds, so to speak, because they're less frequently available.
So on page 25, there's one that I wanted to ask you what you mean.
Okay.
It's Iowa is where you can meet your father long before you were born.
Field of Dreams. Toward the end of the movie Field of Dreams, we know that a man, you know, a catcher appears from the cornfield and the main character knows that's my dad. The dialogue, you know, the back and forth between Kevin Costner and his wife makes it clear that this is my dad before I ever was even thought of, before my dad was married. And it's an extraordinary exchange, certainly, that truthfully, the guys who see that, men who see it, say, look, there's two types of guys. One who cry at that scene in Field of Dreams, and the second, the guys who lie about it. In other words, it's so touching. There's every man who's ever seen it in some way is deeply, deeply touched by that scene. Wow. And so I tried to think about, here we are in Iowa. You know, this is where you can meet your father long before you were born. And that's really just from that movie.
Wow. Now, there does seem to be a lot of, or a certain number of poems in here that are talking about aging.
Yes, And I think I admit that it's something that we notice changes in our own physiologies, you notice changes in our own kind of rhythms and energy levels. Which one, there are several that you might have noticed. Which ones?
Well, the one that I, one of the ones I like best was the first one on page 31.
Okay.
Do you want to share that one with us?
Yes, yeah, this is about the season. Now it's, you know, a little bit later this, it'll be in October when the harvest is really, you know, pretty much underway. And here's what it says. Fall comes and corn dries. Top down, rattling in the wind like old men coughing. And I've had the occasion to stand out. I this sounds really oddball, but I like to go out in the fields. I like to go out and listen. I like to go out and watch. I like to do both and then just gain a feel for what's happening out there. And if you closed your eyes and everything is totally dry. This is the end even of the harvest season and maybe a field that hasn't been quite harvested yet. The everything makes a lot of noise. It's a rattling noise of all the dried out, you know, leaves and stalks rubbing against each other in the wind.
Wow.
And from an emotional distance, it even if it's not a physical distance, it sounds like coughing. And so that's why I wrote it. Now, I don't cough that much, but I've certainly heard people coughing, and at some point, I'm sure I will a lot, is quite possible. So that's why I wrote it. So when
I
the
also
corn is
really
real,
liked afternoon shadows draw deepening
yeah.
furrows in fields and old faces.
Thank you. That's an honest one. I think every honest person looks in the mirror some days, and the light's still. Bathroom or wherever you are, and it's like, whoa, there's some crevices in his face now. There's some canyons. It's harder to shave. It's certainly
I
true.
Bet,
You got to make
sure. I bet. You got to pull it tight.
That's exactly right. There are all these tricks. So, which I never would have thought of, and I'd seen Grandpa do, like he'd stick his tongue inside.
Oh, yeah.
Make the cheek go out farther so it was smooth to shave around. So, I'm trying to be honest about the experience of people as time passes, and I'm glad you're noticing those.
Yeah, I you know, I look in when I look in the mirror, I'm a few years behind you, not that far, but just
Okay.
a few, and so far I look, I say, okay, I still like my face.
So yeah, we want to, you know, have a good, favorable impression of our own lives wherever possible. And I think adjusting to the fact it's going to be looking different has been part of the process for me. I think
yeah, for
it might
sure.
be culturally easier for guys. You know, it's less like, oh, it looks like he's got a lot of character, you know, good character.
Yeah.
And way our scars are souvenirs, you know, of to show we've grown. The experiences of growth may have exacted some cost, but we have dings, just like surfboards have dings or baseball bats have dings, tennis rackets have dings. So we have dings too, I guess. And that's all right. I'm glad you're noticing them. And I hope I don't want to make anyone feel distressed about the changes. I want them to feel, well, this is part of things. And it doesn't mean
Absolutely.
That we're gone.
Yeah. So,
It does.
Lawrence,
It does.
could you
Yeah.
explain? There was one poem I wasn't quite sure, one haiku, or actually, this is a stacked haiku, that I wasn't quite sure what it's saying. And it's the one about Lazarus
Ah, yes.
on
Okay. So
page 52.
Yes. Now, I did get a master's degree in New Testament studies. So I've paid a lot of attention over the years to the Bible, certainly, even though I'm not ordained. And so there'll be many times I'm, you know,
there's
you've
many
seen it.
Biblical references in here. Yeah.
And that's, so if we're looking at Lazarus, was it 55? No, it was
52 on my copy anyway.
That's right. Should I read it? And then
yes,
maybe.
Yes.
Okay. Lazarus had a sister who towers over history though her mystery remains hidden in a scroll stowed in a sunken ship's hull. When her ship rises, hearts and minds will burst in flames, world never the same. Well, Lazarus in the book of John, we know that Jesus, you know, notably raised Lazarus from the dead. It's often speculated that his sister is actually Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
Magdala is often said to be a place, but even well prior to it being considered a place, it's a word for tower. And the first person in the book of John, and actually elsewhere in the Gospels, to come to the cross, to be there at the cross when Jesus is being crucified, and to find the empty tomb is in fact Mary Magdalene. In some ways, scholars are taking another look at how fairly Mary Magdalene has been represented in more recent scholarship, because like Peter, who's the rock upon which Jesus said, I will found my church, she was the tower. It may not have just been a place name at all, that she was a tower of strength and the first to whom, you know, the risen Christ was revealed. And so that's the story about, you know, Lazarus and his sister. The backstory, we could say, that it really represents a desire to honor Mary Magdalene.
And what is the scroll stowed in a sunken ship's hull?
Yes, if you go back, there's I tried in this particular volume to have a lot of linkage between early poems in the book and later poems in the book. And there's another one I'll probably be able to talk about later. But if you go to page 5, it's the top of the page that says it's just a sandbar.
Okay. You want to read that?
Sure. It's just a sandbar in Arizona where creek bleeds into river, but it holds treasures beneath the sand far older than textbooks reckon. Ancients battled here. A Roman ship now lies where fish and salt collide. Salt River and Fish Creek is actually the place in the Superstition Mountains area of Arizona. And there's evidence of Roman presence well hundreds of years before Columbus. And
seriously?
Actually,
I did not know that.
Yes, ma'am. If you can look up something called the Tucson Artifacts. It's easy to dismiss things because it's inconvenient in our textbooks. As a history teacher, I certainly am aware. You don't want to have every single anomaly, every single thing that doesn't fit the customary picture or narrative of history, make the book longer. You know? And it's become a convention then to say, oh, that's a hoax. Oh, we dismiss that. That's not well-founded. We're not sure. Hmm. And so the Tucson artifacts, when they were discovered about 100 years ago, were featured in the New York Times and every other large scale newspaper and museum as an extraordinary find, predating Columbus by centuries. There are many others, and there are books of other examples that would be considered anomalies. And
wow,
they are all over the Southwest, but even here in Iowa, if you go to the Putnam Museum in Davenport, for example. So there are books about them. One is called America BC. Barry Fell, a Harvard professor from 1970s, wrote a book called America BC, which among others, many others, has taken reports of, for example, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments on stones in New Mexico, in Hebrew, that was written in the time of King Solomon 3 years ago. How could it possibly be that nothing got here until Columbus came in the 1492 and beyond? So this is giving voice to what I would simply say is an underrepresented feature of American history. And the claim is that there are tremendous artifacts in terms of value and knowledge, but also value in terms of cultural power, that are contained in this ship that's at the underneath, you know, the confluence of Fish Creek and Salt River, including things like manuscripts from Plato that talk about, you know, I included one poem quoting almost from Plato about Atlantis and its destruction. That was straight out of Plato. And it's not something that is much admitted or discussed at all. That was on page 4. Navigation ceased. Atlantis collapsed into the sea, leaving thick gray mud and sulfur's overpowering odor in its deadly wake. That's page 4, and it's about something that was taken to be routinely the case in Plato's Timaeus, part of which is missing. Well, that missing part is said to be on that ship in its hull. It would be wonderful to have that ship rise, because it would certainly explode the knowledge that's available to us. And that's why I wrote about it at the beginning and the end of this book.
Oh, is anyone, like, are there archaeologists that are trying to find
yes.
it? Or?
Yes, they're, gaining permissions is actually the harder issue. There are archaeologists who want to prefer the simplicity of not having to change the what's museum exhibits or in textbooks what they say, who are not so enthusiastic about the explorations. But there are others who are quite enthusiastic, and it'll become quite soon, I would predict, a situation where new knowledge is so enticing to so many people that any reluctance inherited from the past will be overcome, and we'll find out.
Wow. Well, Lawrence, we are out of time.
My goodness.
I know. And I wanted to close with a haiku that's on the bottom of page 68. Or actually, there's two I want to squeeze in here before we finish. One is the last one on page 69, that where you say what a poem means.
Yeah. Can I talk about that one now?
Yes.
I realize, and I think there are, you know, people, famous poets, who have said similar things. I just put in the three lines. What a poem means is how we feel after we have finished reading. And Frost, for his part, felt in it that he expressed it differently. But the idea is the effect created in our hearts and minds by a poem really are what it means, irrespective of what vocabulary might be included.
Or what the poet intended.
Right. And that's the takeaway may be completely different. And I've had that experience where people are convinced, and I say, well, then that's what it does mean.
Yeah.
That, so certainly.
And then the last one at the bottom of page 68.
Yes. The third one on that page.
Yes.
I wrote this as a graduation poem for one of the graduating classes at Maharishi School a couple years ago. There are many roads to a best possible life. Choose the one you love.
Yeah. And that leads right to one of my favorite quotes from Mark Twain.
Yes.
In his speech on his 70th birthday. Are you familiar with that, Lawrence?
Yes, please. Do you have it in front of you? Because I don't
I do. I mean, he says it in several different ways, but the most succinct one is, he offers this as a sound maxim, that we can't reach old age by another man's road.
Well, I certainly love Mark Twain, and it's very true. It has to be our own, and I'm encouraging the students to choose the one that their heart has responded to. So thank you. No, I'm so delighted.
See you all next week on Writers' Voices.